I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, how many medications do you take every day? How much do you really know about these substances? How did they get FDA approval, and what are the side effects to be looking out for? Was that pill given the FDA accelerated approval pathway? That means drug makers conduct medical trials after approval, and they don't always follow through. How much did lobbying play a role in getting that drug to market? In the new book, Rethinking Medications, Truth, Power, and the Drugs You Take, it exposes the rickety system that creates new drugs. We're joined by Dr. Jerry Avorn of Harvard Medical School. He has spent his career studying the uses, outcomes, costs, and policies related to prescription drugs. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Many of us depend on medication to keep us healthy, maybe even to keep us alive, so it would be reasonable that we should know more about these meds, how they work, their possible side effects, why they cost so much, and even if they do the job that they're supposed to do. Turns out that we're frequently left in the dark about these drugs and how they became FDA approved. Dr. Jerry Avorn has spent his career researching how drugs are discovered, approved, marketed, sold, and sometimes even taken off the market. His new book is Rethinking Medications, Truth, Power, and the Drugs You Take. And Dr. Jerry, welcome to The Source. So in 2023, Americans spent approximately $450 billion on retail prescription drugs. That was about an 11% increase from the previous year. And so that's about 9% of total U.S. healthcare expenditures. So despite comprising only a small fraction of the global population, the U.S. accounts for a disproportionate share of global spending on drugs, paying higher prices for medications compared to other developed countries. And then we frequently have worse outcomes. So explain that to me.
Sure. Well, we are among the only countries, you could even say we are the only country that allows the price of drugs to be set exclusively by the drug maker. Most other countries have an arrangement in which a price is proposed by the drug maker, as it is for virtually every other product that the government or individuals buy, and then people kind of have some back and forth, and there's a discussion as to whether this is the right price, is it too high, is it too low? But alone in the universe, the U.S. allows drug makers to say, okay, here's what our drug costs, and if you want it, you got to pay that. And that's one of the reasons that we are paying the highest drug prices in the world, even for drugs that were invented here, and even when those drugs were invented on the public's dime through research grants from the government.
That sounds like a problem that could be fixed.
Totally. I think a great fix would be to say, let's have a means of deciding what a drug is worth with plenty of generous profits for the drug company that makes it and to cover their research costs and all the stuff that they would deserve for coming up with a drug. But let's have a team of experts with no particular conflicts of interest be able to say, okay, this drug for, you know, the kind we see on TV advertised every evening on the news, this drug for psoriasis or eczema or Crohn's disease, it's pretty much the same as all the others that we have, but it's much more expensive, or it's a real advance and it ought to be commanding a higher price. And to have those decisions made in a kind of normal, either marketplace transaction or with a team of trusted people who have no interest in the outcome and decide like that rather than it costs whatever I say it costs.
Yeah, but those drugs have spiffy jingles and a cool name.
Yeah, and the spiffy jingles and cool names certainly are designed to make people accept the fact that they cost maybe five times what the same company sells the drug for in Europe. But we need to get beyond the jingles and the cute names.
President Joe Biden, he implemented several measures to lower prescription drug costs because this has become such a problem that the politicians have to take action. Through the Inflation Reduction Act in 2022, He put in significant reforms to Medicare's drug pricing policies, Medicare drug price negotiations, out-of-pocket caps, an insulin price cap, capping it at $35 for Medicare recipients. But then, and returning to office in January 2025, President Trump reversed some of these Biden-era initiatives related to drug pricing. Significantly, he rescinded an executive order that sought new models for lowering drug cost. And so now we're seeing Trump talking about his own executive orders to target reducing drug prices, delaying price negotiations, international reference prices, drug importation, and generics. So are we on some sort of whipsaw here? What is happening?
Yeah, I think you put it well. Really, the last administration, that is Biden's, was really the first one to try to get a handle on the fact that a lot of Americans can't afford the medicines that we prescribe. And, you know, it's not just the fact that they're high priced, but, you know, people end up not taking what they need because they can't afford either the copay or some other aspect of the cost. And that's really tragic. And we were making some headway in the last administration. And I think President Trump has been so eager to put his own stamp on things that he has made it a priority, the executive order that you mentioned of last week being the most recent example, to say, we're going to get rid of a lot of that stuff because it was done by the other guy, and I'm going to do other things. But we've read that executive order very carefully, and it calls for doing a study of or looking at alternatives, but it really does not do anything that is as meaningful as the kinds of things the last administration did to really lower prices.
So the next shoe to drop, apparently, in this tariff tantrum that we're getting from Trump, although it's raining shoes, but this next thing, we're hearing that there's going to be tariffs on drugs that are imported. What would that do?
Yeah, and the tariff, which came around the same week as the executive order, the tariff stuff is really concerning because most of the medications that Americans take are made in China or India. It is true, we don't make our own drugs anymore. But the solution to that is not to immediately impose a tariff, and nobody, as you say, knows how big it's going to be, but it's clearly going to be of some size that will matter. And that means that immediately all the drugs that we're importing from other countries, again, particularly China and India, are going to go up by a fair amount that is going to be felt immediately by consumers and patients. And sure, it would be nice if companies made drugs in the U.S., but it takes years and years and billions of dollars to establish a drug manufacturing plant in the U.S. It's not like these companies that are making drugs overseas are going to say, oh, there's a tariff, let's move all of our production next month to the U.S. It's not going to happen in time. And what is going to happen very quickly is big price increases. And if I can just go on with one other worry, a lot of the generic drugs, and generics account for 80% of the prescriptions that Americans fill. It's only 20% of the dollars because they're so cheap, but it's 80% of the prescriptions that people fill. Besides the fact that their price is going to go up, we've seen that generic manufacturers work on such a thin margin that a lot of them might say, hey, I'm a company. I need to make some money on this. I can't make money with these prices. I'll just stop making this antibiotic or this cancer drug or whatever, because it's not worth it to me to put up with all this commercial shenanigans. So I'll just go and make something else that I can make more money on. And then the patient goes to the drugstore to fill their prescription for their antibiotic, their drug for their chronic illness, whatever. And the druggist says, we're on shortage. We don't have that in stock. Why don't you come back in a couple of weeks?
So Trump's scary tariffs on pharmaceuticals could result in the lack of availability in many common, useful, necessary generic drugs, and that will actually make drugs much more expensive. So we're going to talk more about how the drugs get FDA approval. I want to talk about supplements. I want to talk about what's happening at Harvard with your grants. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255. We'll be back in 1 minute.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're speaking with Jerry Avorn. He is a doctor, professor of medicine at Harvard University School of Medicine. His book is Rethinking Medications, Truth, Power, and the Drugs You Take. I'm sure you're probably taking medication. Almost, you know, most of us are. The number to call in if you're wondering, like, how did this drug end up in my medicine cabinet? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, Jerry, the Trump administration is, you know, having a conflict with your university, Harvard Medical School, Harvard University. And also there's cancellation of grants and funding and studies. How is that impacting you?
Well, it is impacting the work that my colleagues at Harvard Medical School are doing enormously. The effect is almost unbelievable. And frankly, many of us don't even know why is this happening. There is this excuse of, well, it's to combat anti-Semitism, which makes no sense to a lot of us. I am Jewish, and I do not understand what anti-Semitism has to do with stopping cancer research or research on why kids get chronic illnesses or any of the other work that's being done at Harvard. And I might add that the other school that I identify with where I was in college is Columbia. And the exact same thing is going on there. And the people there also can't figure out what does this have to do. It almost certainly does not have to do with anti-Semitism. It seems like it is an attempt to bring elite Eastern universities low and really, you know, kind of kick us in the nuts for reasons that are not quite clear. But it's not going to do anything to deal with anti-Semitism. What it is doing is stopping some really important medical research, because that's where most of the dollars go. And ironically, the medical schools at both Harvard and Columbia are nowhere near the undergrad campus where the demonstrations that people are concerned about were going on. We're, you know, miles away, and we do medical research, and it's shutting down a lot of labs, and already has shut down a lot of labs at Harvard doing important research.
Well, they're cutting these medical research grants, funding these projects all over the country, and regardless of the fact that there are important research that, I mean, some of this stuff seems like they're almost there with these breakthroughs. You talk about, right, we're in an incredible age. I mean, we're bagging on these bad drugs, and we're talking about some of these bad practices and pricings and things that are happening. But you also make a point to say there's incredible medical miracles that are happening right now, and more are coming. I'm wondering, are we going to lose a step because of these cuts in funding?
Oh, we absolutely are losing it even as we speak today, Dave. The consequence of shutting down a lab and having people get essentially, you know, a week's notice saying the feds have cut off your research on your cancer drug. You know, there's a lot of talk coming out of Washington about wanting to end waste in government. There is no bigger waste I can imagine than having a project in which taxpayers via the NIH may have put in tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars over the years to try and get to some goal to find a new medication or a new understanding of, you know, why do people get cancer or Alzheimer's disease, and then to be told with essentially no notice, this research is now not funded. That is a grotesque waste, because all of the dollars and all those thousands of person hours that went into getting a project to where it is now, to be told, you know, basically don't come in on Monday, there's no more money for your research. That's much worse waste than, you know, is there an employee in some government agency that's, you know, working only 80% as hard as they should be. This is a big waste and a big tragedy.
Cancer research, Alzheimer's, other dementia research, aging research, things are critical.
Exactly. And, you know, these are hard things to do. I mean, if cancer and aging and Alzheimer's were easy, we would have figured that out decades ago. But a lot of really committed, really smart people have devoted their lives, you know, not making great salaries either, I might add, to try to address these issues. And then to wake up one morning and find out that for no clear reason, the federal government has cut off your funding effective immediately is just devastating.
So in your book, it came out before the Trump administration got on its feet. But, you know, you talk about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and how it appeared that Trump is going to make him the head of the government's department to virtually oversee all the nation's health-related agencies, Health and Human Services. And you point out that Kennedy has been a denier of the benefits of medical products. He is, you know, he was a booster for ivermectin, and you say out in the book that that's useless. It does not. There's no real medical benefit to ivermectin unless you want to get rid of worms. How do you think he's doing right now? And with it, the measles outbreak in Texas continues to spread, and he continues to, lie about that.
Yeah, actually, the book came out today, so we are right at the moment that all this is going on. Luckily, at the end of the editing phase, when they said, "Hey, Jerry, all you can do at this point is change spelling errors and typos," I said, "No, but there's all this important stuff that just happened," and they were good enough at the publisher to say, "Okay, fine, you can add a paragraph here, a paragraph there." And so we were able to anticipate, once we knew that RFK Jr. was going to be put forward as Secretary of Health and Human Services, I was able to say, this is stuff to really worry about. And it's actually come out worse than I had thought, that to have the person that is in charge of all healthcare operations in the government, you know, and Medicare and Medicaid report up to him, the FDA reports up to him, the CDC reports up to him, be a person who has for years and years said vaccines cause autism, vaccines cause cancer, they are really something that should not be relied upon by people. And as you say, right now in Texas, we are seeing kind of the living out of the worst nightmare that many of us might have been worried about when we heard that RFK Jr. was going to be in charge of everything about health in the country, because as we know, that terrible outbreak that you folks are experiencing is primarily among unvaccinated people and, you know, children. You know, there have been deaths, and primarily it's because people have bought the line that vaccines don't work and they can hurt you and they can cause all kinds of diseases. If ever there was a drug or a medical product that had been tested up the wazoo for decades, it's vaccines, particularly things like the measles vaccine.
Well, Kennedy says that the measles vaccine has never been safety tested using blind studies and placebos and things like that.
Yeah, that is just wrong. And he says a lot of things that are simply wrong. It's not a matter of debate or opinion. He says stuff that simply isn't true, like his boss sometimes does. And you can't fact check everything all the time with these guys because they just keep spouting things that are not true. The measles vaccine has been so proven. You know, we didn't have measles hardly at all in this country. It went away. And, you know, when I was a little kid growing up, everybody was getting measles, and some of the more unlucky ones were actually getting very sick from it, you know, back in the 50s and 60s before we had widespread vaccination. And now we don't. And that's not a miracle or a chance finding. It's because the vaccines work very, very well, and they are very, very safe. And it is terrifying to me that the man in charge of all of the healthcare activities of the government spouts these statements that are just completely wrong. And he's done a lot of damage already because people listen to him and his anti-vaccine crusade that's been going on for many years, and they believe it, and they don't get their kids vaccinated, and then the kids get sick.
So what kind of policies could he or is he putting in place that is going to impact the availability of new pharmaceuticals that could help us?
Well, thus far, he has fired the head of vaccine research and evaluation at the FDA, who wrote a very poignant and depressing letter saying, working here would require that I accept a lot of the, this is not a direct quote, but it's the gist of it, that I would have to accept a lot of the lies and misconceptions that you have about vaccines, and I can't function like that. And he basically was forced to resign. And that was Dr. Marks, and his letter has been widely publicized. So that's one thing RFK has done for the country so far. The other is that he has managed to bury in a tweet the idea that vaccines are useful for measles, but he's also been out there encouraging people to use cod liver oil and vitamin A and things that not only don't work, but I've heard reports from doctors in Texas who have said that they're seeing patients or parents of kids coming in, having given their kids mega doses of either cod liver oil or vitamin A, which themselves can be toxic if you give a lot, because they heard from RFK Jr. that that's a good way to prevent or treat measles. And so there's that. And with the just to, the third thing on my list of 400 things he's done that are very scary is that he has commissioned a study of whether vaccines cause autism. And there's two problems with that. One is that it does create the misimpression that anybody who knows this field thinks that's a possibility. No one who has really carefully and fairly looked at the data think that vaccines cause autism. But when people hear, oh, well, the head of Health and Human Services is commissioning a new study, maybe there is something to it. And by the way, he's having an anti-vaxxer run the study, which terrifies a lot of it. And in case anyone thought he had any credibility, he said, and we're going to have this autism thing figured out in 5 months. You know, I have colleagues who've spent their entire adult lives trying to understand autism and how to prevent it and how to treat it. And RFK Jr., who has no scientific training, comes in and says, I'm going to have this figured out in 5 months. It's ludicrous.
He said, I think it was yesterday, that we didn't used to have autism. You don't see people who are 70 years old at the mall, that's what he said, walking around with autism, nonverbal, severe autism, as his rationale for this is a new phenomenon, that we didn't used to have it, which is not true. So, you know, it's but it's just, I don't know, what do you make of that?
Well, this is a common mistake made by people who don't really understand much about epidemiology or science. And that is that people have tried really hard over the last 10 or 20 years to understand, when do you give the diagnosis of autism to a kid? And a lot of these kids were labeled as mentally retarded, which is a whole other diagnosis and a whole other set of problems. And through the work of a lot of careful pediatricians and researchers, we've learned how to tell, you know, kids who are maybe okay but slow, or kids who have mental retardation, or kids who have autism, and how to tell them apart. And we've gotten somewhat smarter at least making the diagnosis, rather than saying, oh yeah, little Fred, he's just not all there, and not even ever writing it down. So that's been a good thing, which he's managed to turn into a bad thing, claiming that it's a new disease we never had before. We were just mislabeling these kids as having mental retardation, or not even making a notation of it at all. And that's, you know, we're better now at it, but that doesn't mean we have a new epidemic by any means.
So are we being set up for something really bad to happen healthcare-wise, public health-wise?
Yeah, we are. And in fact, in your own state of Texas, we have seen this. And for anyone who thought, oh, a bunch of those nervous Nellies back east are just whining about things, you know, we do have, and you guys know this way more than I do, you know, we do have cases of measles, a completely preventable disease, cropping up not just in Texas, but as you know, in adjoining states and now in other states, almost exclusively in people who have been conned by this idea that the vaccine is bad for you. You know, if they get the vaccine, they're likely to be just fine before they get exposed. But if you don't get the vaccine, you're really kind of at risk of getting measles, which can do a lot of bad things. And, you know, we didn't used to have measles. So there's that. There's also my fear that people are going to, now that they hear, oh, the government is investigating the autism vaccine link, you know, if the government's investigating it, there must be something to it. Maybe I'll just hold off and not get my kid vaccinated. And that generalizes to a lot of vaccines. And almost all of these, not almost, all of these worrisome things that are being said are simply false. But it's luring people into the idea that maybe I'll hold off on getting my kid vaccinated. So that's one of the consequences. I'm also terrified about the cutbacks we're going to be seeing in Medicaid to make the budget goals that have been set forth by the administration. Yeah. You can't get that amount of savings without slashing Medicaid.
All right, I got to take a break here. Our phone lines are open. Judith and Sarah, I'm going to get you on the air when we come back from our two-minute break. Our number is 833-877-8255. We're having a conversation about the book Rethinking Medications, Truth, Power, and the Drugs You Take. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about medication, the pills we take to keep us alive, keep us going. But what's all that action behind those pills? We're talking with Dr. Jerry Avorn. He is professor of medicine, Harvard Medical School. His book is Rethinking Medications, Truth, Power, and the Drugs You Take. In the book, you just wouldn't believe all the stuff. It's jaw-dropping stuff that's in this book. Let's go to Judith on the phone. And Judith, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because, it may be close to a year now. I'm not exactly sure, maybe less. My endocrinologist prescribed an over-the-counter drug, but when, because of the amount of MG that he prescribed, I had a really hard time finding it until I went to Whole Foods. I went there yesterday to get another bottle of it, and they told me that neither of their stores had it, and it would be a while before they got it. Now, under manufactured for, it says Whole Foods Market in Austin, but it's manufactured for. So I have no idea where it was made.
All right, Judith, thank you for the call. Magnesium glucinate as the issue here. Also, I don't know if you could talk about that or not, Dr. Jerry, but you have anything to say?
Well, I think what Judith is describing, I have no idea about her particular product that she was trying to get, but I'm afraid that we're going to hear a lot of people saying, I went to get my medication and they said they were all out of it. If the tariffs do what many of us fear they're going to do, especially vis-a-vis where most of our drugs come from, which is India and China, we're going to have people saying they're all out of my drug and they had to call my doctor and he had to try to find something else to prescribe. And that's going to happen, soon, and it's going to happen in a widespread way. And that's kind of a shame because, that's totally not necessary.
These drugs that are manufactured in China and India, are they made to U.S., standards?
They are supposed to be. And the fear many of us have is, it's very hard for the FDA to be able to inspect all the factories in India and China, of which there are obviously many, many thousands. We have not seen too many problems thus far. And sure, I would love it if those drugs were getting made in, Iowa or Nebraska or Texas or Kentucky, but they're not. And we're not going to get there in the next, 6 months by making them unaffordable. But yeah, the FDA does what it can. It's not going to be helped by the fact that there's been massive layoffs at FDA in the last couple of weeks. And a lot of the people in charge of inspecting those drugs and making sure the quality is what it needs to be don't have jobs anymore. So I don't know how in the world that's going to get done.
Let's go to Sarah on the phone. Sarah, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I kind of want to go to talking about how just the mistrust that the Trump administration has caused all over our system of government and the things that we hear in the press. And it's really difficult, like when you hear about something about Columbia and Harvard, the things that are happening there are not meant to actually combat anti-Semitism. They are there to foment anti-Semitism. And if you actually listen to the experts that are out there, they talk about how the government is actually approaching things from a very anti-Semitic way. And I say this from the point of view of someone who has taught students about the Holocaust, and there are experts like Timothy Snyder who talk about it. But the reality is, for people who live under dictators and in authoritarian systems, the number of lies that they, and the amount of mistrust that they create just become so incredibly pervasive across all the systems that you're supposed to trust, that you actually have to think that every time they say something like, we are doing this to save money, you have to actually think, what is this costing me? We are doing this to save lives. How many people are going to die because of this? And it's really unfortunate we've gotten to that point, and I can't imagine what effect it's going to have on our medical system.
Well, Sarah, thank you for that. We have to stick to the facts, what we know to be true, and we can't assume motive, but we just can just say what they tell us and then try to see if that makes any sense or not. But to the issue of trust, trust is vital, and that seems to be in short supply. That seems to be why we're having, like, the measles outbreak, all sorts of issues. What happens when trust completely breaks down, Jerry Averin?
Right. Well, I sympathize with what Sarah is saying. I have relatives who were killed in the Holocaust, and we're very active in programs to try to teach people about how awful anti-Semitism can get when it's out of control. But in terms of what you said, David, about facts, I can't connect anti-Semitism with why it's therefore a good idea to take funding away from cancer research. It simply makes no sense. And the people whose cures are not going to get discovered will not be able to understand that either. But let me come back to the point about trust that you and Sarah were just talking about. An awful lot of healthcare relies on trust, trust that your doctor is able to get the right diagnosis and make the right prescription, trust that the company is going to make the drug well, trust that FDA is going to study it well. And I do worry, as I think Sarah was suggesting, that the fabric of trust is really fraying across the board. I think that we talked about RFK sort of eroding our ability to trust that when somebody says these vaccines are safe and effective, to immediately suspect them of some sort of weird conspiracy theory. We need to be able to trust that our government is making smart, science-based, evidence-based decisions about drugs. And that's all that matters. It should not be ideological. It should be, show me the data. Let's go on the basis of that and make sure that we can trust one another. Once that goes, it gets very hard to get back.
Now, the caller, David, and David, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm 71 years old, and when I was a kid, prescription drugs were not allowed to be advertised on television. Now you can't watch the evening news or any network program for that matter, or almost anything on TV, without being barraged by ads for drugs that are for, everything's for moderate to severe. Then you have a patient, a quote-unquote patient, come on and say, my moderate to severe, fill in the blank, whatever the ailment is. And now they're basically saying it's only for this one very narrow band of somewhere in between moderate to severe. You don't see anybody saying my moderate or my severe. And it's this, we get all this, and this drug advertising is costing billions, and of course they're milking the American market. I see this as just a huge profit thing. But myself, when I see the side effects that they have to mention in these drug ads, I'm scared. Lymphoma, you know, really? My sister has an ailment called this ankylosing spondylosis, and they put her on Humira for a while a couple years ago. Didn't do anything for her, but reduced her kidney function by 30%. So I'm just interested in your comments
on that. Oh, David, thank you so much. So, Jerry, when you see these commercials, what do you think?
Well, they drive me up the wall.
Who are they targeting? Are they targeting the drug consumer, or are they targeting doctors?
No, they're targeting, they have other ways of targeting us. They send people into our office who are very affable and articulate, and they wine us and dine us and take us to restaurants and tell us how great their drugs are. But the ones that we see on TV, which I know drive me up a wall too, David, are targeting consumers. And people should be aware that we are the only country on earth, except for New Zealand, but aside from them, we're the only country that makes it legal to have direct-to-consumer ads for prescription drugs. Every other country has said, this is something that you shouldn't have in a 60-second commercial with actors dancing around and, you know, colorful things to distract you from all the fine print. This is no way to make decisions about what is the best medication for me. And it was illegal here in the U.S. until about 1997. And then what happened was that a lot of health insurance companies tried to say, this drug is really kind of way overpriced and it doesn't work so good, so we're not going to have that covered in our health insurance. And when that began to happen, the drug company said, all right, we'll do an end run around you, insurance companies. We're going to go right to the patients and have them come in and wave a magazine ad or tell their doctor, I saw this commercial last night. Why don't you have me on that? And it was all an attempt to just make every patient into a sales rep, practically. The quality of the information is just so glib and incomplete as to not be the basis for any decision. But I know that a lot of my colleagues who are doing a lot of direct patient care have to spend minutes that they do not have in a visit having the patient say, I saw this commercial, it sounded like that would help me. And it said, ask your doctor. And there, you know, so you have a 9-minute visit to do 30 minutes worth of work, and you're spending 4 of those minutes saying, no, that's actually, I know about that drug, that's not good for you. And the industry is, as David said, spending between $30 and $40 billion a year on that to try to get the patients to induce demand. And it's a crazy way that every other country said, why would you ever allow that? No, you can't do that, but we do.
Is that larding down the price of drugs? Is making it more expensive?
Yeah, because somebody's paying for those ads. And if it is 30 to 50 billion, it's a higher number if you count all the free samples that they give us doctors to distribute to patients. But even if you only count the TV ads, you know, the networks are not giving away that time for free. Those are very expensive minutes on the TV paid for by the drug companies. And what do? They just pass it along by folding it into the price of the medication.
All right, taking a break here. When we come back, I want to ask you about the story you tell about Ozempic. The origin story of it is really fascinating. I want you to tell us that when we come back from the break. And Bill, I'll get you on the air as well. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With us on the line is Dr. Jerry Avorn, professor of medicine, Harvard Medical School, Rethinking Medications, Truth, Power, and the Drugs You Take. An incredible book. We're only scratching the surface of all the incredible stuff that's in this book. Really interesting. Let's go to Bill. And Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah, just real quick, my thought about trust and or lack of trust in science, the medical community, government, stuff like that. And I'm just wondering as a thought, is this not a good thing in the long run where you have folks, you know, who refuse to take vaccines, who refuse to take medications that are good for them, who refuse to understand the science? And at the end of the day, well, if something happens to them, well, so be it. Maybe it's kind of Darwinian, you know, and when we look back on this so many years from now, maybe we'll see this inflection point as being a good thing as opposed to a bad thing.
All right. Well, that's kind of a dark view, Bill, but thank you for bringing that up, and we'll get the response from Dr. Avorn.
I can feel where you're coming from, Bill, and I sort of understand why you would have that perspective. But if we're looking at vaccines, for example, and again, to think about the measles outbreaks in Texas and other states, it's not just the kids who are getting sick from this. And again, you got to wonder, you know, I guess.
Maybe two little girls died.
Yeah, right. And I guess one could say that it's, I wouldn't, but somebody could say, well, that's Darwinian in the sense that, you know, it was not their decision, but their parents. But the problem is that not only do those kids die, but all the other kids who have gotten very sick from measles, but even more so, all the people who have been around them and exposed to them and could get measles from them, you know, that's not their fault. And we know that the measles vaccines are not fully complete until a kid is 1 year old in the normal schedule of things. And we know that there's people who are immunocompromised. My wife is battling leukemia and she has hardly any immune function. And it's frankly very scary, you know, if there were measles in here in Boston to take her out because she didn't do anything to, you know, she got her vaccines. They just got all wiped out by her chemo. And I've got a, you know, grandkid who is 6 months old, who's not old enough to get all of her measles vaccines according to the schedule. So it's the damage to the people at risk who might be very willing to be vaccinated, but for whatever reason, because of age or being immunocompromised, those people walking around with measles because they didn't want to get vaccinated or their parents didn't want them to get vaccinated, they're putting the rest of us at risk too. And that's not Darwinian.
And public policy-wise, outbreaks are expensive. They're going to cost us tens of millions of dollars that could have been prevented with the distribution of a low-cost, effective vaccine. The idea of having public policy is using tax dollars in the most effective ways possible, and that's just not happening when we allow the weaponization of medical distrust. I want to ask you about the story that you tell about the development of the Ozempic and Wegovy, and you say we have a Gila monster to thank for that. Tell me
exactly,
that story.
Exactly right. Yeah, somebody working in an obscure lab found out that there was a compound in the saliva of the Gila monster, which I guess is a kind of a big lizard, that had a property of being able to keep blood sugar low. And, you know, that's the kind of basic research that no drug company is, you know, necessarily going to think to do. It's just so out there. And there were many false starts. It turns out that's exactly what led to the discovery of Ozempic. But a number of companies said, oh, that's ridiculous. Why would we invest money in that? The Veterans Administration, there was a doc at the Bronx VA hospital who was also on the trail of Ozempic. And the VA said, well, we don't know where this is going to lead, and we don't have that much money to pay for this kind of research, and we don't see how it could possibly help veterans. But my favorite story of the origin of these drugs was that the dean of Harvard Medical School, before he was dean, was doing diabetes research, and he got a grant from Pfizer to look into this family of drugs. And even though he had a lot of grants from the NIH, he, for some reason, wanted to get this additional support from Pfizer. Pfizer made him sign a non-disclosure agreement, and this is all described in Rethinking Medications, so that he was not allowed to communicate what he was discovering. And he made a lot of important discoveries about precursors to the GLP-1 drugs that we have today, but he couldn't present them at scientific meetings. He couldn't even write them up as papers, because Pfizer said, we own all your findings. Pfizer then made the really dumb decision to not follow up on that and ended up being sort of late to the party about not having its own GLP-1 drug. And this guy, Jeff Flier, who, as I said, years later became dean of Harvard Medical School, wrote some very poignant articles just last year in a couple of journals that I quote from, where he said, I was one of the only people in the 1990s to see the potential of these drugs, but unfortunately I could not report it because of the arrangement I had made with Pfizer. So yeah, sometimes these non-disclosure agreements that you have to do with, I mean, the feds don't do that. The NIH doesn't say, don't tell anyone about your research, but the companies sometimes do. And ironically, this is like the biggest drug class of our era. And the guy ended up becoming dean of the medical school here at Harvard, but he really made a suboptimal decision in allowing Pfizer to quash him reporting his findings.
So Novo Nordisk Foundation ended up with the discovery, and they're making all of the money, billions and billions of dollars from this. Of course, that's Senator Sanders is not happy with that, and he wants them to knock down the price because they see this drug as being able to help so many people, and they need to lower the price for it. It's where are you on that?
These are some of the most remarkable drugs of our generation, and they do amazing things, and they appear to be remarkably safe. But as you say, and as Bernie Sanders has said, the list price of $1,000 a month is just gonna, you know, bankrupt everybody. And so we're at the point now of trying to figure out, how do you take this fantastic set of discoveries and make them available? They will eventually go off patent at some point. But the companies have gotten so good at extending their patents with what we call a thicket of patents around them. So it's a patent on extraneous stuff that's not the molecule, but it's other things about the drug, that they can make that patent life go on for years and years longer than it was supposed to. So yeah, we have this paradox, fantastic new class of drugs. It's good for obesity, it's good for diabetes, it's good for weight loss, it's good for kidneys.
It's good for Alzheimer's too.
That's probably not true. Okay. I think there's a lot of hype out there where
I'm very suspicious when I hear about these wonder drugs and everything they say is going to do.
Right. Well, you know, Dave, this comes back to a lot of the theme of what we've been talking about. I don't think it makes any sense for anyone to be either pro-medication or anti-medication. All we can do is look at the evidence and have a dispassionate view with no axe to grind. And, you know, if somebody comes along and shows me a good randomized trial that Ozempic prevents Alzheimer's, which from what I can tell, nobody has done, I will be the first to say, yeah, let's give it to everybody to prevent Alzheimer's. On the other hand, if somebody says, I think it prevents Alzheimer's and there's no data, then I'll be the first to get them to quiet down. We just got to all respect the science and the evidence and the data and look dispassionately at, was this a well-done study? Were the outcomes recorded carefully? Was it randomized? And then any of us who really think well about this will say, okay, let's go with that finding. If we can, let's replicate the study. But that's convincing. It's not about ideology. It's not about rhetoric. It's not about conspiracies. It's about show me the goddamn data and then we'll go from there. And that's what we got. That's how we got to the point where we are in medicine. And we've got to really get back to that and use that as our only North Star.
So real quickly, you say it takes about $5 to make a month's supply of Ozempic, although they charge like $1,000 for that. So that's, you know, there's something wrong there. But I'm going to get the evidence, the testing. These things do not happen to supplements. And supplements, it's made from jellyfish, is going to make my memory better, all these other things. That, where do you say, where do you, I mean, you're clear in the book, you think that's almost criminal.
Yeah. Years ago, we had a very good FDA commissioner named David Kessler who tried to get these crazy claims of the supplements industry brought within FDA's, you know, capacity to evaluate those claims. And for his trouble, Senator Hatch of Utah passed a law that said, no, the FDA has no jurisdiction over anything that can be called a supplement. And as a result, we have this Wild West, if I may use that term in Texas, of sort of there's nobody really, you know, in charge. And they just need to have a tiny thing in the bottom of their ads or spoken quickly in their commercials saying these products have not been evaluated by FDA. They're not designed to diagnose or treat any condition, which is crazy because that's exactly what they're advertising. But that's their get out of jail free card. And if they say that, FDA can't touch them. And so you have all these products that do not pass muster in terms of adequate randomized trials. They are charging lots of money for them.
And they may not even be what they say that they are on the label. It could be something like just, you know, grass clippings and they'll call it something else. So, well, yeah, but, you know, yeah, but they could also be doing you harm.
Right. And FDA's capacity to look for safety issues is also much more limited for supplements than it is for real medications. But, you know, the idea is that people will just kind of do their own research and make their own experiments. And it's a terrible idea that we should go back and rethink that whole idea of having these drugs beyond the pale of what FDA can scrutinize.
All right. Well, rethinking medications, truth, power, and the drugs you take. It is an interesting read. Every page is full of amazing insight into the drugs that were given, how they are developed, questions about their approval process, and whether or not they're actually going to do what they say they do, and sometimes they don't. Dr. Jerry Avorn, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, thank you so much.
Thank you, David. I've enjoyed talking with you.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.